Welcome, everyone, to the second episode of Only Murders in the Writer's Room. I'll be your host, Denny Pivac, and there are a few things I'd like to clear up so that there aren't any misconceptions in the near future. Firstly, the reason why I titled my show Only Murders in the Writer's Room is simply a parody of Hulu's similarly titled series Only Murders in the Building. Although there is a podcast reference within that series called Only Murderers in the Building, not murders, you know, murderers, I was more so leaning towards the other title, ergo my show, and the title of it did not mean to imply nor insinuate in any shape or way or form that the creators and writers of the shows and movies I'm talking about butchered their own production. Most of the shows I look over, I personally enjoy, and sometimes, if I don't, I will state that as obvious as possible. So if they happen to hear this, I'd like to apologize to the creators of Only Murders, Flight Attendant, Young Sherlock Holmes, and Knives Out. If you happen to listen to my premiere episode, I really loved your stories, and at no time did I even for a second loathe them. Secondly, the reason I decided to start this show was because I was inspired by many family and friends who believed that I had a charming comedic personality and that it would be suitable for radio, but also enjoyable. But I also grew up with watching the 90s sitcom Frasier, which revolved around a psychiatrist having his own radio show in Seattle, Washington, which is just near where I grew up, which is Bellevue, Washington. With all of that out of the way, I should warn newcomers to the show that, like a majority of the TV channels and streaming services, warn you, the following is only for mature audiences, so this episode, definitely viewer discretion is advised. Now, in this series, also for newcomers to know, we analyze how a show and our movie was executed, then I'll give my thoughts of how I believe it could have been done better. Sometimes I'll change and mix up plot points, plot devices, or plots in general. Other times, I'll just scrap an ending entirely and come up with a completely different one from imaginary scratch. Finally, I'll leave it up to you guys, the audience, if you agree, disagree, or, better yet, if you'd like, tell me your own fan-made ending. And how you can reach me is through my Instagram account, if you have Instagram. It's denny.pivac, that's my account name, spelled DENI.PIVAC. Now, with that also out of the way, let's begin. So, our first analysis of this episode, and our technically only analysis, but it also could be defined as analysis, you know, plural, because today, due to the movie and the holiday's arrival, we're looking over the Halloween franchise that made actress Jamie Lee Curtis one of the most famously resilient final girls of the horror genre. Though we have a limited time, I am a mathematician enthusiast and was able to calculate my rambling for each of the 13 movies to approximately 4 minutes. So, without further ado, spoiler warning to anyone who has yet to see all 13 movies, and let's begin with the recap of the 1978 classic that began it all. 1978's Halloween is a pretty straightforward slasher movie. A man named Michael Myers, played by Nick Castle, escapes from a psych ward with a desire to slash people. His most admirable target, or admirable, is a teen girl named Laurie Strode. Laurie, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, is pretty straightforward too. She lives in the seemingly safe town of Haddonfield, Illinois, has a loving family, gets along quite well with others, and is a good student. Unfortunately, that all came crashing down when Mikey Myers came to town. With the help of Dr. Sam Loomis, played by Donald Pleasance, more famously known as James Bond's arch-nemesis, Blofeld from 1967's You Only Live Twice, Laurie is able to defeat Michael. Now, the climax in Halloween has Loomis and Michael fight on the second story of a two-story house. Loomis shoots Michael several times. Michael goes flailing back and falls over a ledge, plummeting in the backyard. Strangely, Michael survives and returns for numerous sequels, remakes, reboots, and what have you. Though it could be said Michael is immortal, with the sixth installment going so far as to insinuate Michael's a literal demon, I think it would have been even scarier if Michael had been prepared, all along for this battle. With that said, it's time to change, sorry, I mean execute the execution of the story, of course. I thought the film could have shown Michael obtaining a bulletproof vest, and that's why none of Loomis's bullets affected him. Also, inflatable pools and trampolines were pretty popular at the time of filming. Maybe Michael was able to discover the layout of the house and fall exactly on one of the two things. The film also showed Michael scoping out Laurie's neighborhood as he stalked. However, as the film's climax is, it seems implausible for a seemingly mortal man like Michael to have survived not only a hard fall from a two-story house, but also several shots to the chest. The film is still incredible, of course. Incredibly intriguing with an unbelievably catchy theme. You know, the da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And then the soundtrack, of course, is amazing as well. The other scores, other compositions. Also, the credits, amazing. I love the pumpkin, the carved pumpkin of Michael. If nobody really noticed this the first time they watched it, you wouldn't be the only ones. Neither did I, but I actually had to watch a review of Halloween to realize that. If you go on to Dead Meat, it's a YouTube channel. He actually analyzes the pumpkin itself, but not for, you know, too long. But you can see actually that the carved pumpkin is basically the nose acts as the butcher knife, or not the butcher knife, the kitchen knife that Michael is famously known for using as a, you know, weapon. And then you can see Michael's face a little bit, like some hair follicles, but it's not that exact, but it's still pretty great. And then also there are great shots in the movie as well. Now on to the recap of 1981's Halloween 2, or as I like to call it, Halloween 2 Family Reunion. Because if anyone knows the twist, which I will reveal shortly, this is a pretty interesting movie. Taking place moments after the first movie, Halloween night of 1978 to be exact, Michael escapes Loomis and the entire police department of Haddonfield. And what I mean by entire, I mean there are probably hundreds, like at the bare minimum, 100 police officers scouting the neighborhoods and areas and what have you, and no one can seem to find or catch Michael. Anyways, so it's the, what's called, Haddonfield. I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier, but Haddonfield is where, you know, most of the main characters reside. But anyways, so Michael obtains his famous weapon of choice, a kitchen knife, from one of Laurie's neighbors, an elderly couple, but they're not harmed. And then he decides to travel to Haddonfield Memorial Hospital, where Laurie's being looked after, to kill her because he's OCD or whatnot. And along the way, kill some other people. Now, the climax is just as intriguing as its predecessor, with Laurie and Loomis yet again fighting off Michael, also known as The Shape. With Laurie still feeling, as Phoebe's mother from the sitcom Friends would put it, Luffy, Loomis tries to shoot Michael again, but fails. Laurie tries and succeeds. Loomis then opens up gas tanks within the hospital, which I'm not sure why they're there, but it's never really clearly revealed, but still a good MacGuffin. And then Laurie does the same, and then Loomis and Laurie, the two of them, both shoot at the same time, the gas tanks causing a massive explosion. The hospital burns up with Michael in it, and the movie ends showing The Shape, aka Michael's face going ablaze. Now, I never really liked this ending for numerous moral reasons. One, with so many gas tanks open, Laurie and or Loomis would have been affected by them. Loomis especially, considering he was close to becoming senile, would have faced tremendous gas poisoning. With that said, it's time to execute the execution. Paying homage to its predecessor, the film could have had Loomis shooting Michael several times, with Loomis carrying two guns, the one he had and the one he originally gave to Laurie, ending Michael with a definitive headshot, which is, in most horror films, the best way to defeat the main antagonist or villain. The second reason the climax does not work is because, on a technicality level, Loomis and Laurie blow up a hospital. God knows they could not have been the only patients inside. Sure, there could have been evacuations or whatnot, but I highly doubt so many would have escaped before Michael's demise. If the film needed something climactic, like an explosion, the effects budget could have been utilized entirely on a climax where Laurie and Michael fight atop the hospital's helicopter roof landing. I don't know if they had one, but I've seen a few that do. Now, Laurie could have turned on a gas tank, sending it flying into Michael's chest with the force causing an explosion. Considering the third film has almost no connections or ties to the previous two, either theorized climax could have been perceived much better than what I believe was given to us. However, this does not mean yet again that I hate this movie. Halloween 2 has just as catchy a theme and soundtrack as its predecessor, haunting credits, and great shots, pun intended towards Loomis, of course. As for Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, that's a whole other story. The 1982 science fantastical horror film takes place in an entirely different universe. Although seemingly similar to its predecessors and ours, in this universe, 1978's Halloween is merely a movie and briefly commercialized when the main character, Dr. Dan Challis, played by Tom Atkins, more famously known as Detective Ray Cameron in 1986's Night of the Creeps, watches it at a bar. Now, in this movie, Dr. Dan Challis is on a mission to reveal the culprits of murders that have been occurring increasingly around Northern California. What's their connection? Silver Shamrock's novelty Halloween masks. The relatively new company has made countless masks with medallions attached on the back, and no one knows why. However, Dr. Dan Challis soon discovers it has something to do with an ancient ritual. This movie slash installment slash requel goes complete bonkers with its ideas, and I, for one, enjoyed most of them. However, I did feel the story could have addressed a certainly crucial thing: Michael's infamous mask. With that said, it's time to execute the execution again. Though it is believed Michael is immortal, I would have believed that too if Halloween 3 did as well. I assumed because of the direction the film was going with, aka supernaturally linked Halloween masks, it would reveal Michael's mask was also supernatural. Maybe it gave Michael immortality and that is why he was able to return each and every time he was seemingly defeated. The film would not even have had to add Michael as a supporting character, but just merely mention his mask, or at least previous experiences with similar masks. Fun fact though, although Michael Myers is not a character in this movie, the actor who portrayed him, the, I guess you could say, stunt double in Halloween 2, named Dick Warlock, plays one of the android assassins in Halloween 3. So in both films, both sequels, he plays a killer. And yes, I too realized the comedicness of the actor's name, Dick Warlock, but I also remembered how uncomfortable that joke actor Patton Oswalt made about actor Finn Wolfhard's name. A name given by someone and kept for so long most likely means it holds some sentimental or special value to that person. No one ever should make fun of one unless said person acknowledges their name to be for comedic purposes. But anyways, getting back to Halloween-esque references, actor Dick Warlock has also worked on countless other classic horror films and franchises as a stunt coordinator, from 1982's The Thing to 1990's Child's Play 2. Jamie Lee Curtis also cameos in Halloween 3 as an announcer on a radio. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch is by no means one of the worst horror movies of all time, and not even one of the worst installments of the Halloween franchise itself. It's just its own thing, and I like it for that. Oh, and another fun fact that I just remembered connects Halloween to the horror genre. The director and writer of Halloween 3, Tommy Lee Wallace, not only worked on the original Halloween as an editor and production designer, but also played Michael in the infamous closet jump scare. He also directed and wrote the 1990 adaptation of Stephen King's It, the miniseries, and 1998's Fright Night Part 2, and yes, there was actually a sequel to that movie, and 2002's Vampires Los Muertos, unexpectedly starring John Bon Jovi from Bon Jovi's This Is My Life. And you know what I'm gushing in. And if you'd like to learn more about the incredibly talented cast and crew of Halloween 3, I highly recommend scrolling through their IMDb pages, because it is a wild ride. As for 1988's Halloween 4, things get back on track for the Michael Myers crack. A decade after the events of Halloween 1 and 2, Michael has been in a coma and is about to be transferred to an all-new hospital. When he hears he has a niece, been binging too much Boy and Girl Meets World lately, Michael decides to go after her. Now, this was some crucial information I left out for my recap and theorization of Halloween 2. In Halloween 2, it was revealed that Michael and Laurie Strode are brother and sister. So that makes Jamie Lloyd, who just so happens to be Laurie Strode's daughter, also Michael Myers' estranged niece. Anywho, played by Halloween alumni Danielle Harris, Jamie Lloyd is really the best and at the same time the worst character of the Halloween franchise, but we'll get into that later in the sixth installment. For now, Jamie Lloyd is just a sweet, innocent girl who has an obsessive admirer. Now, if you thought I was talking about Michael, you would be forgiven. Unfortunately, in this movie and sequel, the obsessive admirer I'm actually referring to is the return of Madman Loomis. Donald Pleasance returns as an even more unhinged and persistent version of Dr. Sam Loomis. In the movie, not only does his entire career revolve around the Myerses, but so does his character. Thankfully, Loomis is able to remain sane for a majority of the climactic ending and convince Haddonfield's police officers to join forces to defeat Michael. They ambush the Shape, aka Michael, near an abandoned mineshaft. Guns go a-blazing, and Michael is shot close enough to go flying into the abandoned, now open, mineshaft. When all seems fine and good in the neighborhood, Dr. Loomis returns to Jamie's home to check on her, and discovers Jamie in her Halloween costume, covered in blood and holding a kitchen knife. If that wasn't bad enough, Jamie is dressed up as a clown, the same thing her uncle Michael was dressed up as when he performed his first kill. The movie ends on a bizarre cliffhanging twist, which the sequel obviously does not follow up, but what if it did? It's time to, yet again, execute the execution. Only this time, what's going to be different is Halloween 4's ending and 1989's Halloween 5 are going to connect, with Halloween 5 being completely scrapped, the original plot, with an all-new one entirely. Now, the ending to Halloween 4 could have implicated that Jamie killed someone, but with no one knowing about it, so there wouldn't be this dramatic reveal of, oh, she's covered in blood and she has a weapon in her hands. She's obviously a killer! No. Maybe this time, Loomis could have discovered the body later, or in the sequel, and it was presumed one of Michael's victims. The ending plays out like this. Loomis returns to Jamie's home. As he's talking, the camera backs away, trailing up a staircase, and then going to Jamie's foster parents' bedroom. Within that bedroom is a bathroom, and within that bathroom lies Jamie's foster mom's bloodily mangled corpse in the bathtub. The tub is nearly about to flood with water, but the camera pulls away again and goes over to Jamie's room. We see Jamie drawing a female clown killing her mother, with the audience still unaware that's supposed to be Jamie. The camera then performs a Dutch angle, and Jamie looks up and gives an evil grin for the camera. The movie cuts to black, credits start to roll, and an operatic version of the Halloween theme begins to play. Though it probably was difficult to predict what the new millennia would be like and bring, Halloween 5 sadly could not have been set 25 years later, unlike how the 1978 original, its predecessor, time jumped after Michael's first kill, from 1953 to 1978. However, similar to Halloween 4, it is plausible to utilize the 90s as much as possible. With that in mind, Halloween 5 could take place a decade after the events of Halloween 4, October 31st, 1999. With the murder of Jamie's foster mom still a mystery, Jamie is now a young adult and still living in Haddonfield. Working on her bachelor's and acting as a teacher's assistant, she seems fine. Since the budget, however, of Halloween 5 was lower than most franchising films at the time, the film probably could only afford an actress who still hadn't reached overwhelming stardom. With that also said, I think actress Robin Wright from 1987's The Princess Bride would be a decent Jamie Lloyd, an older Jamie Lloyd. With a similar hairline, squinty eyes, and her hair dyed black, she could pull off the Jamie look. Anyways, this Halloween 5 would be a cut flashback movie, where half the movie is dedicated to adult Jamie, and the other half is dedicated to young Jamie. For a majority of the film, Jamie is just acting normal, with abnormal things happening around her, from murders to disasters, the people of Haddonfield believe that their town is officially cursed. Donald Pleasance returns as an older Loomis, and soon discovers the culprit behind Haddonfield's mishaps is Jamie. Unfortunately, Loomis cannot gather enough evidence to put Jamie away. The final third of the film has Jamie and Loomis at each other's necks. Unexpectedly, the Shape, aka Michael Myers, returns, but it dons a new mask. With blonde hair, a pink tint, and hollower eyes, similar to the one seen in Halloween 2 and Halloween 4, for just a glimpse second, this new Haddonfield slasher is on a roll. As for the new cast of characters slash victims, pun intended, I couldn't think of actors, anyone in particular, to play them, but I do believe the characters should follow the same checklist as most other horror films did at the time. Either they are really horny but naive, or really smart but delicate. As for names, these are some I thought off the top of my head. Connor, the bad boy stereotype, dresses like a biker. Alice, though a prom queen stereotype, her looks give off bad girl vibes. Riley, the socially awkward teen stereotype, he dresses like a band member of Nirvana. And Tammy, the nerdy girl stereotype, though she dresses similarly to Riley. They're high schoolers who have worked with and known Jamie Lloyd for quite some time. Eventually, they run into Dr. Loomis at their high school, who also eventually runs into Mikey Myers 2.0. Paying an homage to a kill from Halloween 2, Mikey stabs Loomis in the back and then hoists him up like a cow in a meat freezer. Trembling due to nerves, Loomis dies from shock, and then Mikey sends his body sliding down the school's newly waxed floor. I know that was a weird detail, but it'll make sense if the movie was ever made. It just barely touches the shoe tips of Connor, the body, who looks in horror and then looks back up at Michael. He and his friends go running around the school, only to be denied the freedom as all the exits are locked. As a quick thinker, Connor breaks a glass box mounted on a school wall. In it, an emergency axe, which Connor uses to break the glass squares of the school's front doors. His friends escape, but Connor decides to stay behind and fight off Mikey. The two struggle for quite some time until Connor gets a little too curious to see who's behind the mask and reveals Jamie. That's right, Jamie Lloyd has taken on the mantle of the famous slasher, The Shape. Like uncle, like niece, I suppose. Connor is then stabbed by Jamie. Alice looks in horror as she sees her lover try to crawl back to her, but Jamie uses Connor's axe to strike Connor some more, and then some more, and then some more, and then... You know what? This is getting a little bit too emotional. I'm going to fast forward to the final fight. Tammy finally gains bravery and gets Jamie to follow her to a chemical factory. There, the two duke it out on a bridge that is above vats and vats of toxic chemicals. Tammy gets the slip on Jamie, and Jamie goes flying over a railing, just barely holding on to it. With one last hit, Jamie goes falling into the chemicals, but it transitions to now a teenage Jamie. She's rappelling down the open mine shaft her uncle fell through years ago. This is now a scene, or ending, showing how Jamie not only became Mikey 2.0, but was also able to get away with most of her murders. After Michael had fell through the shaft, his body was retrieved immediately and taken to the morgue. There, younger Jamie grabbed his mask and knife, then delivered Michael's unmasked body to the cremation center. With many thinking Michael was still alive, no one ever knew that he had actually died and someone else took his place. Except for her foster mother, All of Jamie's other victims have been hidden away in the open mine shaft. Her victims were presumed missing or dead, but no one exactly knew which was which. One night, Jamie went to a Billy Idol concert in Tinley Park and was inspired by his physique to transform Michael's mask into something else, someone else. And fun fact, I actually had to look that up because the only concert Billy Idol ever performed in Illinois that I could find out about was on September 1st, 1990 in Tinley Park, Illinois. So that's actually historically accurate. Now, as the same operatic theme from Halloween 4 starts to play, Jamie's in the open mine shaft, holds up her mask to the moonlight, and its reflection transitions us back to the future, where older Jamie finally plummets to her death. The credits start to roll as the vats of chemicals start to get sucked down by pipes from below. When the credits end, a little whirlpool of chemicals yet again makes a transition, this time as the mouthpiece of Michael's mask. Giving a horrifyingly masculine scream, the mask flies at us like in 3D, implying that the shape will return once more. And it kind of flies cartoonishly like a ghost, like Casper, what have you. And technically, considering how Halloween 4 and 5 played out, Michael did survive, but not in the same way I expected them to write this in. Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, is one of the most, if not the most, divisive installment in the franchise because of how ballsy it got with both its titular storyline and character arcs. From adult Jamie's sudden death to a cult that Michael and a fraction of Haddonfield's population are part of, Halloween 6 is a romp for all the wrong reasons. With that said, it's once again recapping time. 6 years after Halloween 5, Jamie, now played by Days of Our Lives alumni J.C. Brandy, has been abducted and kept as, for lack of a better word, slave to the cult of Thorn. There, she has been subjected to get pregnant, with whom I will not say, since to this day it still disgusts me, but I will just say these three words. Sweet Home Alabama. If some of my listeners did not get that, ask a friend of yours obsessed with TikTok. They'll be more than happy to answer, I'm sure. As for Jamie, she eventually gets pregnant, but a nurse who delivered her baby decides to help Jamie escape from the cult. Unfortunately, the two end up sacrificing their lives to have the child. Now, although I did mention earlier that Jamie was both the best and worst character of this franchise, this sixth installment mainly made her the worst because she was not a main character. No offense to the actress who plays her, but the film should have utilized adult Jamie, mind you, a lot more. But they didn't. So, the next day, after what happened, Tommy Doyle finds that same baby, Jamie's baby, at a bus station. Tommy was a character introduced in the 1978 film, the original, you know, Halloween, a kid that Laurie Strode babysat, but he's now played by Paul Rudd just a few short months after 1995's Clueless kicked off his stardom, so it's kind of, I don't know, I guess trendy? I'm not sure. Funny how he was in one of the best and one of the worst movies in the 90s, but I don't know, I just kind of found it an odd choice. They could have gotten anyone, really. Anyways, Tommy takes the baby to a hospital and just so happens to bump into Donald Pleasance as Dr. Loomis, who I presumed was waiting for some victim of Michael's to arrive, because if he wasn't, sicko much? The two begin to plan to defend themselves against Michael, but luckily are given two more teammates, Tommy's cute neighbor slash crush, Kara Strode, played by Marion Hagen, and her son, Danny, played by Devin Gardner. That's Danny, spelled with an A, two N's, and a Y, unlike my name, which is spelled with just an E, one N, and an I. Though you may see it or hear it as Dini, like Houdini, it's actually pronounced Denny, like that fast food chain that serves way too salty food. Anyways, the four main characters try to find the headquarters of the Cult of Thorn, but instead, they find the leader, Dr. Terrence Wynn, a minor character from the 1978, again, original Halloween. Only he's been recast again, like the others, with another actor, Mitchell Ryan, who also played a villain in 1987's Lethal Weapon. The main villain, mind you. Underwhelming twist or overwhelming character-forced entry? Either way, it sucked. Thankfully, the four main characters are able to fight off both the Cult of Thorn and Michael, but their futures are left as a cliffhanger for a presumed sequel, quote-unquote. It never happened, most likely never will, and should never because, one, they killed off a titular character that had been developing for nearly a trilogy, aka Jamie Lloyd, in the first few minutes. Two, the film tried to turn a subtly horrific franchise into a bonkers soap opera-esque film series. And number three, compared to the producer's cut of the film, this version of Halloween 6 deserves to be shunned. Bad news, no executing the execution tagline for this piece of junk. But good news, we go on to the 1998 requel, reboot slash sequel, Halloween H2O, which holds quite a lot of nostalgia for me as it was one of the first few horror movies I was introduced to. Instead of recapping time, it's now memory lane. It was the summer of 2015. I just settled down after my month-long, adrenaline-pumping, heart-pounding obsession over the science fictional thriller series, The X-Files. Binging nearly all the seasons, I felt a little tougher to indulge myself into something even more scary. Since Prime Video was at its peak then, at least that's what my nostalgic goggles calculated, I was able to explore countless 90s horror films, ranging from Halloween H2O to Scream 3. First horror movie I watched ever was Scream 2, though I didn't know much about its predecessor, The MacGuffin, a film within a film, aka Stab, helped me get back on track. Already, I was not only hooked by horror films, but also by films from Dimension Studios. Unknowingly, I was already a fan of theirs prior, growing up watching Spy Kids and Jackie Chan movies, but I also found their horror movies a little more tame and enjoyable, with the exception of a few Halloween movies. However, due to the pigs that own them, I won't be praising too much of the studio. If you'd like to learn more, just go to the Wikipedia page of Dimension Studios and scroll down to the founder. Anywho, Halloween H2O acts as a reboot slash sequel, or requel for short, as 2022's Scream ever so graciously publicized it. Taking place 20 years after the events of Halloween 2, this movie completely erases the weird androids of 3, the niece turned psychic from 4 and 5, and the terrible cult from 6. It's a great timeline to start fresh. Pun intended. Jamie Lee Curtis returns once again as the nostalgic final girl, Laurie Strode, now a high school teacher and mother in Summer Glen, California. Under the new identity of Carrie Tate, she and her son, John, played by Josh Hartnett, of Penny Dreadful fame, are enjoying what the Southwest has to offer. Unfortunately, Michael soon discovers their whereabouts and arrives for some unorthodox season greetings. Along with television director Adam Arkin playing Laurie's love interest, Michelle Williams from Manchester by the Sea playing John's love interest, Prison Break alumni Jodie Lynn O'Keefe as the token horny student, Jumanji alumni Adam Han Bird as the token oblivious student, and NCIS alumni LL Cool J as the token comic relief, Michael has his hands figuratively and at the same time literally tied. Though I found this movie to be on the same level of excitement, terror, and comedy as the Scream saga, I do have a few tiffs with it. One is how H2O addressed the loss of Dr. Loomis. Sadly, Donald Pleasance passed away on February 2nd, 1995, several months before Halloween 6 was even released. I believe due to the stature and popularity of Donald's character, Dr. Loomis, the film did not think it proper to recast him, which is proper, and also, you know, understandable. However, if anything, H2O was already going that route when you really think about the character arcs. With that said, it's time to execute the execution. This could have been a Next Generation storyline with Lori, in a manner of speaking, passing on the torch to her son. With new and younger characters introduced, the sequels could have dove into their futures, mainly focusing on Michael's repercussions that haunt them for eternity. Also, I preferred H2O being a reboot-sequel hybrid because it also gave the franchise the chance to erase the concept and or development of the crazier and more unhinged Dr. Loomis, seen in Halloween 4, 5, and 6. Though Donald Pleasance passed away years before H2O was made, the film was able to get masterful impersonator Tom Kane to do the famous monologue that Donald had done in the 1978 original. However, it was crazy to hear how similar Kane sounded like Loomis. And then I thought, if H2O followed the Next Generation storyline, why couldn't have Kane played the descendant of Loomis's? Since Pleasance was nearly 40 years older than Kane, maybe he could have played the grandson, nephew, or even distant relative of the persistent psychiatrist. He could have arrived at the movie's halfway point, introduced himself, and then it transitions into an old versus new battle, Michael Myers against the descendants of his enemies. I mean, H2O is a generational special on its own, considering much of the advertising for it at the time was simply 20 years later. I mean, when you think deeply about it, H2O, or Halloween 20 years later, is not much of a captivating title. However, at the same time, H2O is also known for being the scientific title of water, and most likely to the diehard fans, that's what this movie was like. Water. You know that feeling you get after sweating all day, you've worked up an appetite, and all you wish for is a cold bottle of water that you haven't had for hours? That's what the movie H2O is like. You haven't had it for quite some time, and once you do, you feel somehow whole again. As for Halloween Resurrection, that movie was like, since we follow in the footsteps of three horror classics, why not muck the fourth one up as most franchises do? Since H2O started an all new timeline, with the only movies connected to it including the 1978 original, the 1981 sequel, and Resurrection, so yeah, for some unknown reason, we're going back to the fourth installment / the quadrilogy curse, where, for some unknown reason, whenever it comes down to a quadrilogy for film, the fourth installment is cursed as the worst. Examples include Batman and Robin, Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, Alien Resurrection, Bloodsport 4, The Dark Kumite, Kickboxer 4, The Aggressor, 1994's Next Karate Kid, House Party 4, Down to the Last Minute, and finally, Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. But anyways, enough ranting about the curse, let's talk about the resurrection. Due to the rising popularity of reality shows, more so the competitive ones, for example, Big Brother, Survivor, Halloween Resurrection spoofs at the concept by revolving around a reality show titled Dangertainment, where a bunch of unbeknownst people are locked up inside an infamous historical area, whether it be a haunted house or a dilapidating castle, and have to confront their fears. Serendipitously, so the movie can happen, the cast of Dangertainment have chosen a group of people to enter Michael Myers' childhood home. When Mikey finds out, old Mikey, he ain't that happy and decides to trick rather than treat his unwelcomed house guests. Now, the group consists of showrunner Freddie Harris, played by nostalgizing rapper Busta Rhymes, Sarah Moyer, played by Bianca Kailich from the sitcom Rules of Engagement, Jennifer Danzing, played by Katie Sackhoff of Battlestar Galactica fame, and Rudy Grimes, played by Sean Patrick Thomas from the Barbershop Trilogy, and you know what? There are way too many late 90s, early 2000s famous celebrities listed on the Wikipedia page. I'm just going to continue with the basic synopsis. So, as the film progresses, the group of people get picked off one by one by Michael. By the end, Freddy and Sarah are the only ones remaining of Dangertainment. The two fight off against Michael, with Freddy saying a pretty memorable one-liner, but due to radio etiquette, I'm gonna turn on my good placinator so the curse words sound less Kersey. The classical line goes, and I quote, "Trick or treat, motherforker." If you have trouble translating my edit, literally go on YouTube and type in Busta Rhymes trick or treat line, and I'm 95% positive the first video will be the exact correct one. With that said, boy oh boy, do I have a lot of tips with this movie. In the first few minutes, the point of H2O is completely diminished. Firstly, Laurie Strode is killed off again. I may have forgotten to bring it up, but Laurie died in a car accident sometime during the previous timeline, aka Jamie Lloyd's trilogy, aka Halloween 4, off-screen, of course. Thankfully, but also not thankfully, we see Laurie get killed by Michael. And how does it go? Well, after Laurie abandons her family yet again, she decides to put herself in a psych ward. Michael finds her, Laurie booby traps him, and then Michael uses that same trap to trap Laurie along with him and eventually kill her. Oh, also in H2O, Laurie axed off Michael's presumed head. That's right, the main villain died, like I said before, which is a very good kill, an efficient one at best, a definitive headshot. Or, I guess, head slice would be a better word choice. Unfortunately, Resurrection retconned Michael's death by revealing that before Laurie could kidnap and kill her older brother, he swapped outfits with a paramedic. So, Michael managed to fake his own death. Wow, I really did not think he was that smart, but anyways, he did. With all that out of the way, and all many more numerous ifs I could go into, we have just so little time to get into five more Halloween movies. The next two are complete remakes, if you can even call them that, of Halloween and Halloween 2. Formerly known, or I guess more famously known as Rob Zombie's Halloween from 2007, this movie completely alters the Halloween story. Similar to my idea for Halloween 5, this is a cut flashback movie, where half of the movie is dedicated to showing Michael's backstory, or flashback story, and the other half is dedicated to showing Michael's future slash Laurie's life, his sisters. And this movie, weirdly, I'm not going to say it's a bad movie. It's far from it. If anything, this makes me feel more sympathetic for Michael because his childhood in the movie was shown to be really rough. I mean, his father was abusive. His mother was not very protective and not very understanding nor much caring for him. Never really there for him. And it's just really sad. But on the other hand, it is really, really hard to sit through. If anybody's ever seen, watched, or sit through a Rob Zombie movie, you know this man is famous for exploitation horror. And basically what that is, it's really grotesque horror. Like, you can think of the grossest thing you've ever seen, multiply that by a factor of like 10, maybe even 20, and that's basically a Rob Zombie movie for like the next hour and a half. And the funny thing is, when I first heard about this movie, I looked it up on Amazon to see if there were any good reviews on Prime Video and whatnot. And what was so funny is the mask and the outfit in general caught my eye, because the DVD cover of Rob Zombie's Halloween is a pretty intricate DVD cover showing Michael's mask almost looks similarly like the Purge masks. And if anybody doesn't know that horror franchise, they have kind of almost porcelain doll-like masks with hollow eyes, and it looked really intimidating. But then I watched the movie and saw, oh no, it's completely the same mask. There's almost nothing different. It's the William Shatner inside out, hair poofed out, you know, and all that shabam or whatnot. And
You know, like, I can't really think of a way to dive into this movie because I can't also at the same time execute this movie any other way imaginable. Like, I'm not against it. I'm not for it. This is just, I guess, what can you really expect but, like, from someone like Rob Zombie? You hear Rob Zombie's Halloween, and you know it's gonna go really crazy. And so does the sequel, of course. But that's a whole other story. But we'll move on from those two. Just know, I don't hate them. I don't love them. I'm kind of mixed. But we'll move on to the next alternate timeline, which completely erases nearly all of the previous movies, except for the original, the 1978 original. We begin with the quote-unquote sequel, Halloween 2, also known as Halloween 2018. This takes place 40 years after Michael Myers' first reign on the town of Haddonfield. Everybody is like, okay, they know about Michael and whatnot, and it's not seen at first as a really traumatizing event. People just know that he killed a few people and that he, you know, was locked up. And people also started rumors, like they were saying that Laurie and Michael were related. And in this movie, it's actually retconned that Laurie and Michael are brother and sister. In this movie, they are not actually. They are just mano y mano. And it also seems like Laurie also started a family after the events of Halloween. She not only had a daughter, but also a granddaughter, Allison. Allison, throughout the series, from Halloween 2018 all the way to Halloween Ends, has a pretty interesting story arc, and, or I guess better yet, character arc, because how they go with it is, at first, they make Allison sympathetic for Laurie, because everyone else sees her as the crazy old woman who, you know, fought against a psychopath. And she doesn't see her as that. She sees her as this very protective, very, I guess, not socially awkward would be the best word choice, but distant woman. And she understands what she was put through, what she went through, and it's really nice to see this dynamic that also at the same time, Haddonfield is not filled with complete jerks. You know, there are some people who still understand and care for one another, even during the hard times, and even during the even more scarier times, and unknown times, of course. But I gotta say, a lot of the acting and the performances and the writing and the directing was actually pretty decent. Like, I, even though some characters were unlikable, a majority of them were likable. Like, there were some extras who, I guess, were utilized as townsfolk who, you know, nagged at either Laurie or Allison or whatever. But a majority of the cast, actually, I found really enjoyable and, I guess charming is the word I'm looking for. They were really charming. I laughed hysterically at actor Jibril Ntambu's performance as Julian, a kid that's being babysat by another character named Vicky, played by Virginia Gardner. Those two have an unimaginable chemistry. They're always either teasing each other or mouthing each other off or, you know, talking like adults. It's just hilarious. And also what kind of blew my mind was how the Julian knew exactly what to do. He, like, almost in his mind said he already had a first aid kit of, like, horror protection. He knew the moment the door opened, someone was in, he got out. He's not gonna deal, you know, with that psychopath. Also, Miles Robbins plays Dave. Now, I did not know that that actor was related to Tim Robbins, who is famous for his role in The Shawshank Redemption, written by another horror icon, Stephen King. That was so unbelievable to me because I hadn't seen him at least that I can think of, any other performances, but Miles Robbins, you nailed it as Dave. Like, this guy wasn't a jerk like most typical boyfriends are in horror movies. He was chill, he was friendly, he was even protective, actually. When Vicky was being attacked and then sadly eventually killed by Michael, Dave actually went up to try and stop and protect her, and that was, you know, really sweet. As for Judy Greer's character, Karen Strode, alongside Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, playing, obviously, the mother, she is the GOAT. I mean, the ending scene where she confronts Michael is so creative. And I won't give too much in detail in case there are, you know, some people who are in the midst of seeing Halloween 2018. But the scene goes like this. So, Allison and Karen are locked in the basement of Lori's place. So, Lori completely, like, security-proofed her whole house so that she would be prepared, as well as her family would be prepared, to face against, you know, some form of evil, specifically Michael. And now the basement's being unlocked by Michael, and you don't see him at first. You know, you think there's going to be a jump scare, and Karen knows she has to draw out Michael. So what does she do? She freaking starts wailing. She's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I can't pull the trigger. Michael pops out and she says, gotcha, and blasts him with the shotgun. I'm like, oh, chef's kiss. That was brilliant manipulation. Like that is like, oh my God. I did not expect that at all. Like, I thought she was overplaying it a little bit. And I was like, wait, what's going to happen? Is, like, he going to jump down or something? But, man, was that, like, a really GOAT moment. Like, greatest of all time Halloween franchising moments. And then we go on to Halloween Kills. The filler in this nonchalant new quadrilogy. Now, I'm not going to say Halloween Kills is a bad film. Far from it. When I saw this on Peacock, which sadly, I know, I saw it on Peacock. I wish I'd seen it in theaters. This movie is kind of a so bad, it's good. Because there are a lot of great suspenseful moments, a lot of great fights, a lot of great acting, a lot of great tragedies. It's just an overall pretty decent. But this is obviously a filler to get to the next phase, to get to the final film. Because I think, and I got this from some other sources and reports, originally what David Gordon Green and Danny McBride wanted when they originally rebooted the franchise was to do a trilogy. So it would have been Halloween 2018, or actually not Halloween 2018, sorry, Halloween, the original 1978, then Halloween 2018, and then Halloween Ends. But Universal decided to prove a fourth film to squeeze in between Halloween 2018 and Halloween Ends. So they had to make Halloween Kills, which is also at the same time similar to H2O, kind of a weird title like Halloween Kills. Why not have Halloween 2018 be called Halloween Kills, and maybe, I don't know, Halloween Kills Again for the sequel, because it just seems weird. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Anyways, Halloween Kills is a pretty okay movie. If I had to rate it, honestly, it would be probably a good 8.5 out of 10. It's not the best in the franchise. It's not the worst. It's just, it's there to fill in the space for the series. Like, as most television shows do, and most television show creators will tell you, there always got to be a filler to fill in the time, because sometimes when writing stories, like I'm talking right now, rambling on, trying to film this whole hour, it's really hard to stretch out a story for as long as you can. There's just some difficulties along the way, and sometimes just to draw a blank. Now, we've reached the end, kids. Halloween Ends. The supposed final film in the Halloween franchise. Boy, do I have a lot of things to say about this film. So, originally why I wanted to see a Halloween movie in theaters was because I wanted to hear the classic theme be played in a cinema, and I could hear those speakers boom out those musical notes, those haunting notes. I wanted to hear like the da na 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 na, and it would have just been chilling, you know. But what does the opening do? It makes me so uncomfortable before those incredible notes can even ring. So, the opening has a guy named Corey Cunningham, played by Rowan Campbell from Hulu's The Hardy Boys, an all-new series. I just actually found out about it, even though I'm a pretty huge fan of the 1970s Hardy Boys series with Parker Stevenson and Sean Cassidy. Anyways, the opening has Corey coming to a home with a seemingly nice couple, introducing themselves and saying, "Hey, we need help. We are going to this benefactor or some party of theirs that they need to go to. It's not really important." Anyways, Corey is on babysitting duty for this couple's kid, this family's kid. And at first, it seems like a pretty nice relationship, actually. At least for the first minute, I thought the kid and Corey seemed to get along pretty well. It made me reminiscent of, like, me and my brothers and also my cousins' kind of friendship. But then after the parents leave, wow, does that kid change drastically. He just becomes a complete jerk. And then what does he do to make himself even more of a jerk? He plays a prank on Corey, who's pretty sensitive. Like, he's somewhat the socially awkward stereotype, or the token, you know, awkward teen. And the kid locks Corey up in a basement. Not basement, not up. He locks him up in the attic all the way on, I'm assuming because of how tall they showed this house to be, like the third story. Anyways, he locks him up, and the Corey gets so frustrated that he starts banging on the door. He starts banging, and the kid, for some reason, and this kid is truly a jerk. The writers made sure to make him a jerk so you don't feel at least the bittest sorry when he goes. I mean, it's still sad it's a kid, but like, this kid's a real jerk. Corey slams the door, and the kid goes flying over the staircase and dies, sadly. But what's so weird is this opening makes you so conflicted and uncomfortable. You don't know what to feel for either character. You're like, do I feel bad for Corey? Do I feel bad for the kid? Should I not feel anything at all? I don't know. But then as the movie progresses, I thought the movie was going to reveal Corey was going mad. Because after seeing what he did, he goes into a phase of like repression, regression, what have you. And then as the movie progresses, it slowly starts to reveal that Corey is slowly becoming Michael because he's going crazy and, like, whatnot. But I thought to myself, wait, so is he going to take the mantle of Michael Myers? Because that would kind of, in a sense, reboot the franchise or reboot this, at least, trilogy. Kyle Richards' character from the 1978 original, who's also played by the same actress, she even says in one scene when she gives Allison, I forgot what they're called, but they're like kind of future fortune teller cards. She says, an all new chapter is going to begin. And I thought, oh, could this be it? An all new chapter is going to begin? But no, it's just, it really leads to nothing. Halloween Ends is okay. Halloween Kills is okay. Really, all the movies are okay in their own way, and I see that I'm nearly running out of time, so I'm just going to leave it with this. The Halloween franchise, if I had to rate it all together, I'd give it a 7.5 out of 10. Half of the movies are good, half the movies aren't so good. It's just kind of a roller coaster, you know? There are some points where you're going to enjoy it, some points in the ride when you won't, but overall, I think it's a pretty memorable ride.
that's about it, guys, for the second episode of Only Murders in the Writer's Room. Once again, I'm your host, Denny Pilac, and if you'd like to reach me, once again, I say you can reach me through my Instagram at denny.pilac, or if you like me spell it out, make it more easier, it's spelled DENI.PIVAC. I know it's spelled Pivac, but it's actually pronounced Pivac. Whole long story that I'll probably never get into. But thank you guys to many of you who stayed and were dedicated to stay this long into the episode and me ranting about the Halloween franchise. I hope everyone has a great Halloween. Stay safe, stay cool, and see you soon.